The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Chha. On the show this week,
carbon nanotubes and buckyballs probably brought closer a nanotechnology revolution.
It's in the cells of every living thing, and now carbon is the gateway to a new vista of technology. Professor Ravi Silva tells us about the coming age of electronics made from carbon. And
the amount of enthusiasm that there is in science journalism at the moment is really buzzing atmosphere, and everybody seems so enthusiastic. It's very encouraging.
Last week, The Guardian and the Wellcome Trust celebrated and honoured some new voices in science writing. We'll hear from the winners of the inaugural awards and find out from two oldish hands what makes a good science writer. I'll also be joined by Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample to go through some of this week's science news, including a reconstruction of the genome of the Black Death using ancient skeletons. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. In our Nobel Prize special last week, we spoke to one of the University of Manchester researchers who received the Nobel Prize in Physics for the isolation of graphene. Konstantin Novoselov got his award because of the incredible potential that graphene and other new forms of carbon hold. Now, you know all about diamond and graphite as forms of carbon, but there are also buckyballs, nanotubes, and the aforementioned graphene. Each of them have strange and remarkable properties. The nanoscale science related to these materials is thought by many to be the start of a new age of carbon, perhaps even a new industrial revolution. One of the advocates of this idea is Professor Ravi Silva, director of the Advanced Technology Institute at the University of Surrey. He recently gave a lecture at the Royal Society all about carbon electronics. And when I spoke to him, he started by telling me about the scale of what we're talking about, how big a nanotube actually is.
Well, graphene is an absolutely incredible material. To start off with, it's a single monolayer of carbon. Now, to put that into perspective, if you think of a millimeter length scale, you can typically put 3 million layers of graphene within that 1 millimeter. Now, to put that into a different perspective, if you take your millimeter scale and expand that, say, to the size of the Eiffel Tower, which is of the order of 300, 320 meters, and if you now imagine your 1 millimeter, the size of your Eiffel Tower, and you try to locate the size of your graphene layer, it will still be of the order of submillimeter or a tenth of a millimeter. So it is a very, very thin, fine layer. Now, with that brings its problems because of its difficulty in handling. It means that there is a significant influence of the substrate and its surroundings on the electronic properties. So although the original discovery of graphene came about with the use of a simple scotch tape technique where you peeled out layers of graphene, say with a pencil, you can draw on a sheet of paper and then start peeling out with scotch tape. And if you are very, very clever and experimentally skilled, you can get single monolayers of graphene. But the beauty is being able to recognize the properties of the material, the isolation of the material, and then being able to make devices. Now, why would you want to make devices of it? Effectively, the electron mobility associated with graphene has a magnitude that is of the order of 2,000 centimeters squared per volt per second. Now, to put that into context, most of the electronics we work with are based on silicon microelectronics, and the mobility of silicon is 1,500 centimeters squared per volt per second. Now, compare 1,500 with 200,000, and that is the enhancement in mobility that you get. Now, the term mobility means it's the velocity of your electrons when you put an electric field across your semiconductor.
So the resistance is just much, much lower across this layer.
it's not just the resistance, it's purely the resistance for the charge to travel. So it's basically how fast an electron can whiz across a surface. So typically speaking, in microelectronics, the techniques that you used in order to make devices faster was to make the distance the electrons had to travel smaller and smaller. But in the case of graphene, due to its enhanced mobilities, you can potentially have much larger scale devices working at similar speeds simply because you have such an enhancement in your electron velocity on top of your graphene layer.
Now, microelectronics based on silicon and those sorts of rare earth metals have revolutionized the 20th and 21st centuries with computers, LCD displays, all those sorts of things, electronics and everything we're using to broadcast now. They're all based on silicon. Could all of that be replaced by graphene in some time to come?
I think it's going to be a very, very tall ask to see whether silicon can be replaced or will be replaced. I think silicon as a material is an amazing material, and after years of research associated with silicon, at present, you can purify silicon to such an extent that you can get extremely good quality material. And similarly, in the case of silicon, it has a huge advantage that if you oxidize a silicon wafer, you create a dielectric that are the two essential components in making a device structure. Now, graphene, on the other hand, will have to be placed on other materials for it to have the necessary components to make an electronic device. Certainly, in the area of electronics, carbon-based electronics can replace silicon in niche areas. But if it is to replace silicon completely, I think that will take many, many more years of research in order to achieve that position. But in the very high-speed applications, in dielectrics, in areas of light emission, there are already niche applications and products coming out at the prototype stage.
So tell us a bit about those prototypes. We're all excited about graphene. There's been £50 million of research money invested by the government just recently into ways of trying to make graphene commercialized. What kinds of directions do you think that money could be going in?
Well, typically, one of the areas that I believe that will be first exploited would be in areas such as transparent conductors. So every display that you have, whether it's liquid crystal or other displays such as those that you find on touch panels, your iPads, have got something called a transparent conductor on it. So this is based on indium tin oxide. And indium is a rare earth material that is scarce. It is a conducting material. Yes. So the advantage associated with graphene is that you can have this monolayer or two monolayers of carbon that can replace indium tin oxide and have a touch screen that has the electrical properties or the conductive properties that allows it to have the functionality associated with the electronics and still be portable and useful. So I think from a transparent conductor's point of view, graphene certainly has a ready use. When you start looking at other electronic devices in areas of sensors, once more, due to its vast surface area, you will probably find graphene sensors being used. And already, instead of some of the metal oxide materials that need to be heated in order to get necessary energetics of the surface, graphene on its own has very, very good sensing properties. You can start looking at electronic applications too, for transistor applications, but this is going further afield. But the research needs to be done in order to have the next generation or two generations down a technology to be developed at the present time.
So what about things like solar cells as well? I mean, I believe that graphene has interesting properties where you could use it to harness the energy from the sun to make electricity.
That is correct. In the case of solar cells, you can look at it from two aspects. One, you can look at it in order to absorb things, but once more, you can also start looking at it in composite materials to enhance absorption, or you can look at it from a transparent conducting point of view. So I think there are many, many applications that has graphene at the heart of its use, but once more, graphene on its own will not be able to do all of these various technology applications. So therefore, it has to work in synergy with other material systems. And I think part and parcel of the government's initiative of putting $50 million into creating a new graphene hub is being able to find material systems that can work synergistically with the properties of graphene in order to exploit it. It's very interesting, if you do look at countries such as China, there has been significant investment in R&D of new materials, and that I believe has helped them in their manufacturing base and being able to come up with cheaper products much more readily nowadays than previously based on the huge investments that have taken place in the last decade.
Now, carbon was the source of the Industrial Revolution back in the 17th and 18th and 19th centuries. Is it going to be the cause of another Industrial Revolution, this time at the much smaller scale?
Well, strange enough, I think it might be of a much larger scale, because I think carbon nanotubes and buckyballs probably brought closer a nanotechnology revolution. And I think the products are just about now hitting the market. So it's quite possible that it could be even bigger than any of the other industrial revolutions that we have seen thus far. And as we well know, in order to have a strong economy these days, you need to have manufacturing. And to have manufacturing, you need to have technology. And the technology generally has to come with innovation. I think the UK is extremely lucky and fortunate to have some of the pioneers in carbon electronics in recent years contributing. These range from Professor Sir Harry Kroto to Sir Richard Friend and Donald Bradley, and much more recently, Andrea Geim and Kostya Novoselov, who've all certainly helped enthuse hundreds and thousands of researchers like myself and school kids and others to start working in this field.
To see Professor Silver's lecture, you can go to royalsociety.org/TV. It's time now to talk about some of this week's news stories, and here to go through them is The Guardian's science correspondent, Ian Sample. Hello, Ian.
Hi there, Alec.
Now, before we go on to my excellent plague story, well, it's not an excellent story, it's an interesting plague story, let's talk about some molecular biology from your end. iPS stem cells, there was an interesting paper in Nature about using iPS stem cells to grow liver tissue. Just tell us a bit more about it.
So this work looked at people who have a liver condition called antitrypsin deficiency. Now, they have liver cells that produce a protein that is supposed to, in normal people, this protein goes around the body in the bloodstream and it basically acts to protect your cells and tissues from damage. Now, if you have this condition, that protein doesn't form properly, so it just gets stuck in the liver. That does two things. It causes liver damage directly. You get cirrhosis. But also it leaves the rest of your body pretty vulnerable, and especially the lungs. So these people develop conditions like emphysema. Now, what this work did that was really interesting was they got a patient who had this liver condition, took a skin cell. They take the skin cell, reprogram that into a cell which is pretty much like a cell which is pretty much like a stem cell, an induced pluripotent cell, these so-called iPS cells. They then use a molecular technique to correct the single letter defect in the gene affected, and then you check for any flaws that you might have introduced by accident, and then you convert those cells actually into liver cells. So what you've done is you've taken a skin cell, correct the genetic mutation, convert them into liver cells. Now, they're not able to do the last stage, which is put them back into a patient, because you need to go through a vast number of trials before you can do that. But they put them into animals, into mice, and they show that those cells not only function absolutely they survive normally. They produce the right kinds of proteins. They are healthy cells, and they should work in humans as well, you'd imagine.
Now, ever since iPS stem cells were first made a few years ago by Japanese scientists, they've been seen as the sort of replacement, perhaps, for this the embryonic stem cells that everyone, which is the gold standard when it comes to producing all sorts of tissue from stem cells. There have been problems with iPS when it comes to the chemicals you use and the genetic modification techniques that perhaps make the cells you're transmuting back into iPS non-usable in humans. Now, have they got over those sorts of issues? Is this the beginning of the applications?
Well, there are two nice things about this research in particular on this point is, first of all, they have techniques in here whereby they strip out any sign of them having gone in and manipulated these cells. So, first of all, you reprogram the virus using these factors which are delivered through a virus. All of that stuff is gone by the time you end up with your liver cells at the end. There's also, when you make the actual genetic correction to the fault, all of the sort of enzymes that are used to do that, they're all removed from the cells as well. Now, so you can, the cells you have at the end are liver cells that are corrected, that are healthy, and have no, there is no sign that they've been through this process. Now, they have been these iPS cells, so they are re-differentiated after going through that step. And there are some concerns over whether there are subtle differences between those cells and the normal cells that you'd expect. And so what you can do with that is you probably wouldn't inject these straight into people. What you can do to be sort of ultra safe is you can actually put them in what would amount to a porous bag. So you have your cells, your liver cells that you've just created, you put them in a kind of bag and you implant this into the body. You can put it pretty much anywhere in the body, but you don't need to put it in the liver, because all those cells need to do is have some sort of nutrient supply, and then they will start producing this protein that will look after the rest of you and will keep keep your organs healthy. So you don't actually need to inject the cells and have them there. So if they become sort of tumors, then you're in trouble. You can actually do it a lot safer than that.
Now, one other tantalizing thing about iPS stem cells is that there's no chance of rejection when you insert this stuff back into patients. Can you just talk a bit about that? I mean, is that why people are going down this road?
Well, one of the motivations for going down this route was because of the issues surrounding embryonic stem cells. And those issues are ethical, but they also touch on practicalities, such as the method for creating patient-specific stem cells, as these would be, was the kind of work that the Korean researcher Hwang came up with, which was fraudulent. No one actually achieved that. There are still serious hurdles to producing patient-specific cells through the cloning route. The other issue is getting hold of eggs. That is still a problem in getting hold of enough donor eggs to do it. And so many researchers see this reprogramming route, where you take an adult skin cell, reprogram it to a younger, more versatile state, and then turn it into an adult cell, as being the way forward.
Okay, well, let's move on to an ancient disease, the Black Death. There was another paper out this week about the sequencing of the genome of the bacterium that caused the Black Death. Now, just to put that into context, things that get sequenced all the time. There are 1,000 sequences published every week, nothing special, except that obviously the Black Death happened in the 14th century. So how do you get the DNA samples and how do you reconstruct it to get the sequence? And so this paper by a bunch of scientists that in Canada at McMaster's University and also the University of Tübingen in Germany, it was a tour de force, actually. They managed to reconstruct 99% of the ancient Yersinia pestis, which is the bacterium in question. They reconstructed 99% of that genome from the insides of teeth of victims of the Black Death back in the 14th century. They dug these the plague killed millions of people across Europe, and many of them were buried just outside London, at least the London victims, and these were excavated back in the 80s, and they're kept in the Museum of London. And these scientists in the latest research, they went to the museum, they got samples of teeth, and inside the teeth there were these this black powder which contains DNA from all sorts of things, and they fished out the DNA of the bacterium and actually put it all together. I mean, it's an incredible demonstration of what you can do with genetic sort of sequencing technology nowadays.
Why was this bacterium so dangerous, so lethal at the time?
Yeah, so Yersinia pestis, which caused the epidemic, is, and one of the interesting things they found was that the sequence is almost exactly the same as the sequence of the bacterium that exists today. There's almost been very little change. And today there are no plagues and epidemics of this stuff, I mean, partly because we have better drugs. But also, I think the scientists sort of speculated on why the Black Death did as much damage as it did. I mean, over 5 years in Europe, it killed something like 70 million people, almost 40% of the population sort of succumbed to this. And there was a couple of reasons why it was particularly bad. The Hundred Years' War was just about starting, so lots of sort of war and mischief going on there. The climate was actually cooling, lots more rain, which meant that the crops all over Europe were failing and rotting in the fields, and so people were malnourished. They were immunologically suppressed. They didn't have much food. Basically, they were exhausted, and the bug actually preferentially killed people who were already frail and the poorest in cities. And it was a combination of all those things that actually sort of caused it as badly as it did. I mean, one thing that's interesting from this, I mentioned before that this is an ancient piece of DNA. They reconstructed it partly to sort of understand a bit about the Black Death, but also, I mean, the technique of reconstructing old DNA or old sequences, like, and potentially old pathogens, gives you a lot of information about how things traveled around the world. It gives you a new insight into history. And I mean, the only other thing that's been reconstructed is the 1918 Spanish flu virus, which is the deadliest flu virus ever to emerge. You can argue about whether that was a good idea, but I mean, scientifically, it was an interesting thing to do, I think.
Given that there was a lot of other stuff in the material that they would have been testing, how do they know that these genes that they're testing for this bacterium are actually from the Black Death, are from those ancient infections, and they're not some more modern contamination?
Well, so the stuff that was sampled was the inside of the teeth from the cemetery. There's four teeth, and inside there's this black powder, as I said, which contains dried blood, nerves, other biological tissue. It contains bits of soil, other bacteria that sort of leached in there over the 700 years that these things were under the ground. So what they did was, using what they knew of the modern sequence, they used that to create essentially a sort of molecular fishing rod that would attract only the DNA from this particular bacterium. They got all that stuff together and they were able to do the sequence. Now, they don't know what order the genes are in. They don't know much about, they didn't actually reconstruct this thing. Therefore, they don't know why it was as virulent as it was. They can't tell from this particular thing. But they were fairly confident that they only got the DNA from, 99% sure, they said, actually 99% of it was gone over at least twice to check that it was actually the plague DNA. And about 98% of it had been gone over three or four times. So that's why they're fairly sure. Actually, they published a paper in PNAS a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, which showed the technique they used. If anyone's interested, you can go and read that, which was the proof of principle. And then this Nature paper is the full sequence. Now, how do they know it was just DNA from that? Well, this paper explains it. This is how they did it. The question I kind of had, and which they do answer in a certain way in the paper, is how do you know that the old sequence that you constructed is the entire thing? How do you know there wasn't extra bits out there? And, you know, I mean, I'm looking at this from a sort of lay point of view, but they were fairly sure, because it's a circular genome, they know what should be there. They're fairly sure that they had the whole thing. And they were able to do sort of calculations on how much mutation has been, how much mutation there could have been in there. So, you know, it's a bit of one of those complex genomic questions which only geneticists kind of understand and can explain to each other, but hopefully one of our readers can maybe explain it a bit further to me. Anyway, I'm going to leave it there. If you want to read more about this or Ian's story about the iPS stem cells, you can go to guardian.co.uk/science.
And now the Hanford question. My name is Simon France. I'm a writer and editor and blogger at Nobel Prize Watch. And my question I'd like science to answer is, what is the biological or molecular basis of free will? We don't know what free will is. We don't know what makes us think subjectively. Can we get into the inner workings of the brain to find out why we make certain decisions over others, why we decide to go down certain paths over another, and what is the basis behind all these things that we just have no clue about?
We're always banging on here about making sure as many people as possible know as much science as possible. So we thought we'd put our money where our mouths were and set up a science writing prize to find new voices to expand the worlds of journalism, blogging, and podcasting. Actually, it wasn't our money, but rather that of the Wellcome Trust. The winners of the two categories, one for professional scientists, the other for everyone else, were announced by comedian Dara O'Brien at a glitzy ceremony last week at the Wellcome Collection, which also featured speeches from Alan Rusbridger, editor of The Guardian, and Mark Wolpert, director of the Wellcome Trust.
Okay, good evening, everyone. My name is Mark Wolpert, and I'm the director of the Wellcome Trust. And I'd like to welcome you, that's with one L, because this is a writing prize.
I'm Tess Shellard, and I've just won in the Keen Amateur category for the Wellcome Trust Science Writing Prize.
Tell us what you wrote about.
I wrote about a slightly esoteric subject, quorum sensing in bacteria, which is I find really fascinating. I saw a conference talk online from Professor Bonnie Bassler of Princeton, talking about the fact that bacteria actually time their gene expression, which was incredible to me. So whatever it might be, bioluminescence, pathogenicity, they time it so they wait until they're sufficient in number for it to be fully effective. And that, I thought that was incredible. And it has massive implications for the way we design our medicines for the future. So I decided I would write about something that I was really passionate about, so I went for that one.
So this has been a splendid collaboration between the Wellcome Trust and the Guardian and the Observer. And so it's a particular pleasure to be able to introduce Alan Rusbridger, who is the editor of the Guardian.
Now, it happens that we have had a succession of brilliant science journalists at the Guardian, with people like John Maddox and Phil Tucker and Tim Radford, and Alok James, Ian Sample, the brainiest people on the paper by far.
I'm Penny Sarche. I'm doing a PhD in plant genetics at Oxford, and I was reading through some press releases of research going on at Oxford, and I came across this research that they've been doing into the nocebo effect, which is the evil twin of the placebo, and the kind of effects it might have medically. So that was in Irene Tracy's lab. And just the wider ranging implications of that I thought were really interesting. So I went out and did some more reading, and just the fact that the trust you have in your doctor has that much effect on you, and likewise, the fact that we might sue our doctor at any given point, the fact that that could be affecting your own treatment, I thought was really interesting.
Tell us what the nocebo effect is.
So it's the opposite of the placebo. So when you take a sugar pill and someone tells you it's going to make you better, in a significant-ish proportion of people, it will make you better in some way. So the nocebo is the opposite of that. Someone gives you a sugar pill and tells you it's going to give you a searing headache. Quite a few people will then feel a searing headache. And so it's this idea of the power of suggestion being a very bad thing.
What's the most important thing, do you think, about science writing? What are you going to take away from this?
I thought what was really interesting was the wide background of the people who got shortlisted. Anyone can do it. You need someone who's a good writer and someone who loves science, and that isn't necessarily a scientist or someone who's got a writing background. So I thought that was really inspiring. And also just the amount of enthusiasm that there is in science journalism at the moment. It's a really buzzing atmosphere and everybody seems so enthusiastic. It's very encouraging that there is an audience out there for this kind of thing.
It's great to be, ladies and gentlemen. I have done a little bit, I am by, you know, previously by training before I ran away to circuit, I did theoretical physics. I've drifted slowly into that kind of thing with doing Stargazing Live with Brian Cox, and we'll be doing more of that kind of stuff. There's a lot of joy to be taken from great science writing. There's a website that I found today that many of you would not be familiar with. I did think, to be accurate, I should write down it was the way in which science writing can illuminate and can entertain. The website is called Blackboards in Porn. It's a celebration of pornographers who've gone that extra mile in set dressing a classroom scene. And with a still, which is safe for work, which still actually goes through what's on the blackboard and rates it with regard to its scientific accuracy. It features key quotes like a discussion of the unusually high pupil-teacher ratio, which features rather a lot. Whoever you pitch as your audience, know this, they are underserved. They're underserved by genuinely interesting new things because the media is strapped for cash. And I'm sure you'll agree with this, a lot of the time they have to, not yourselves, I'm exempting you, deliberately exempting you from this, they have to fill their space with pictures of Kim Kardashian and Lindsay Lohan and people we don't care about but are told to care about. And the only science thing they'll run is the equation for the perfect sandwich or some nonsense like that. There is a huge audience for what you are hopefully about to continue doing. A massive audience of people who are hungry for this kind of stuff.
Earlier in the day, the shortlisted candidates, all 30 of them, came into the Guardian HQ to hear from some relative old-timers on what makes a great science writer.
Okay, I'm Stephen Curry, and I'm a professor of structural biology at Imperial College and a science blogger.
I'm Michael Renier. I'm a science writer for the Wellcome Trust.
Well, I'm not quite sure how to begin this. So, Alec asked us to talk about what makes a good piece of science writing.
What makes a good piece of science writing? I think it has to be something that is relevant to the reader that you're aiming it for. So you have to know who your reader is, you have to know who you're writing for, and no matter how abstract your science, you have to find some way of relating it to them and their experience.
There's nothing really terribly special about writing about science, per se, and the secret of success in any kind of writing is to tell a good story. So the advice we've always had from Tim Radford and the greats like that is that it's about capturing the attention of your reader and clinging onto that as tenaciously as you can all the way to the end of the piece. And finding a way to do that is the real secret. I enjoy reading a lot of popular science. I'm interested in sort of history of science. But one of the scientists who I've read who's been a great popularizer is the protein crystallographer Max Perutz, who works in the same area that I work in. He's interested in what molecules look like. And his writing really was a sort of inspiration to me in part, as well as his work being an inspiration.
This was a Nobel Prize winner who was equally accomplished in communicating his science as he was in his science. I think science is, I mean, it's so rich for stories. People are fascinated by science, even the things that they can't necessarily touch or they can't see because they're too far away. Science does hold a fascination for most people, I think.
Well, the other thing we talked about earlier was that for scientists who are getting into science writing, there's an enormous temptation because of the way that we're trained to be so precise and to always mention caveats and qualifications about the information that we're presenting. And that sort of standard is perfectly fine when you're writing for the peer-reviewed literature. But actually, if you're writing for a more general audience, for a newspaper or a blog or whatever, then I think you should have the freedom to be a bit more streamlined in the way that you tell the story, and you are allowed or should allow yourself the permission to edit yourself and omit sort of various complications and qualifications. As long as you adhere to the spirit of the truth of the story, then you can't go far wrong. And so that you know it's important not to overhype something. But it's easy, I think, to trip up a good story by having a sort of digression into some long piece of explanation, which you kind of feel as a scientist, well, I think they need to know this as well.
Exactly, which goes back to your first first point, which was because if you put in that digression to be comprehensive about the science, you will lose your reader in a fraction of a second. They'll be gone. So. So yes, avoid the temptation to try and put in everything about the science. Focus on what it is, on the story you're telling and what's needed to tell that story, and leave out everything else, even if it kills you a little bit inside.
It does. And since it's something that doesn't come naturally to scientists, any scientist who's thinking about doing that kind of writing, it's really a matter of practice. And you've got to, read the stuff that works, have a look at New Scientist or the writing, the way things are pitched in The Guardian, for example, and try and analyze, what has been left out, how have they streamlined it without actually losing, the core of the story and the heart of what's been discovered or what's been found out. But it will be something that doesn't come naturally. You're likely to find it very difficult at first, and so it's just important to, have a crack at it and keep going until you get it right.
If you want to find out more about this year's competition and ready yourself to apply for next year, check out our site guardian.co.uk/science/science writing prize. That's all we have for you this week. For the best breaking science news on the web at any time, just go to guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.